we got a little bit into chapter 7 of Deot last time, and we're going to conclude Deot and chapter 7 of it, which is the final chapter this time, just sharing my screen for those online so we can review a little bit about this important topic. So we did the first few halachot, but just a little bit of a reminder. Rambam in this chapter goes completely into a different topic than in the rest of Deot, which, remember, was about, you know, what food you eat in what season and your bowel movements and how many times you should have sex each week and all these things regarded to health. And then gradually merged into kind of your friendship group and how you make good friends, and how you treat other people. And now in the final chapter, which is to him the capstone of this whole section, the Hilchot Deot, the laws of human behavior, this is really the culmination of all of that, which is about how we use our words. So we saw the introduction of several concepts. The idea of being a rachil, right? Rechilut, which is one of the words we use for here for gossip, is probably a good translation. And rachil is actually a market trader. So the connotation is that you're hearing something, there's something you hear one place and you go somewhere else and you say it there and it spreads like market traders go between towns. That's one aspect, is spreading gossip between places. The next one was motzi shem ra, which is to actually defame someone, to give them a bad name. This actually came up in our parasha this week about a husband who defames his wife by saying she wasn't a virgin when they were married. He uses the exact same phrase, lehotzi shem ra, to bring out a bad name. And then we get to the broadest concept, which, as you can see, if you're looking at the English, Rambam introduces by saying there's a much more serious sin, which is called lashon hara, which is the one we speak around the most. Right, and lashon hara literally means, you know, the tongue of evil, or speech of wickedness, or however you might want to understand it. But it's clear that this is about using your words to harm, and we take that very seriously. That words actually can do real harm. The common childhood nursery rhyme of sticks and stones may break my bones, but words will never hurt me, would make no sense to Rambam or to most of the traditional Jewish teachings, which say actually the opposite. Who cares about sticks and stones? Words do the real damage. Right? And the basis of that ultimately, which he doesn't say here, but is obviously the case, is that we believe words are so powerful because we believe creation was done through language. So if the world can be created through the power of words, if God can say, let there be light, and there's light, then words can have the same power of destruction as well. And, you know, Proverbs says death and life are in the power of the tongue. Our rabbis say silence is a fence for wisdom. There are numerous texts which talk about the importance of being careful with our words. And yet Jews are also known almost universally for being big talkers, right, who love the power of language and of comedy and of you know, humor and all the things that require using words in often non-literal ways. But Rambam's definition of Lashon Hara is very specific. Let's just review. He says, Lashon Hara is saying, that's what so-and-so has done. His parents are such-and-such. This is what I heard have heard about him, telling uncomplimentary things. So you're not actually saying stuff that's super negative. You're just saying, oh yeah, I heard that guy did this thing. Or, oh yeah, you know his parents. It's very subtle here. It's not defamation. You're not bringing a bad name forth and saying that person did this horrible thing. It's not slander. It's just introducing into the conversation the idea that someone maybe is a little bit less than decent. It's a very, very minor, subtle thing that he's describing. But that is the most serious of all linguistic sins, he tells us, because of how complacent it makes us around the power of language. That seems to be the implication. And Rambam cites this very famous passage from the rabbinic literature that there are three sins which actually diminish a person's standing in this world and deny them a portion of the world to come. So you both are punished now and punished later. And those are idol worship, sexual assault, and murder, which we know. And we'll talk about that more in depth, by the way, those three sins. But then the text says, and Lashon Hara is equivalent to all of them, which is a real hyperbole. To say, oh yeah, you know, Jim's parents is equivalent to murder, sexual assault, and idolatry all at the same time is a really extreme statement, in case that's not incredibly obvious. Right, and then they go on. He cites another passage from the rabbis to say, anyone who says Lashon Hara is like someone who denies God exists. Right, so casually mentioning how your neighbor's cousin, you know, had this unfortunate incident at work last Tuesday is basically the same as denying God exists. And then in most, probably the most extreme version, which is a tough competition because they're all extreme, the sages say, and he cites it here again, the Lashon Hara kills three people. And we mentioned this a little bit earlier, the one who speaks it, the one who listens to it, and the one about whom it's spoken. By the way, the kills is the intentional word there, right? It actually, horeget, it says in Hebrew, it murders them. So this, you know, kind of hard to avoid the language around this being pretty extreme, pretty explicit, that this is something we must take seriously, and there's not really any way around it. We saw in the fourth halakha, we're just reviewing some of the material we saw before, that there's lots of things which are almost derivative Lashon Hara, called here Avak Lashon Hara, the dust of Lashon Hara. So they have a resonance of it, but they're not exactly it, which are interesting examples where you say, oh, I don't want to hear about Jim. I won't tell you what he did. Well, you're not actually speaking about him, but you're leading someone to be curious enough to ask, and thus about him it will be spoken. So you have a responsibility not just to not use the bad words, but also to not encourage a way of conversing which encourages people, your listener, your conversing partner, to actually investigate and ask questions. You don't want to lead people on to get this position. And there's a great example here quoted about King Solomon accordingly wrote the Proverbs here in chapter 27. One who greets his colleague early in the morning in a loud voice curses him. And the way they interpret this is like, you know, if you go out into the street in early in 5 o'clock in the morning and you see your friend, you go, oh, hey, Jim, really loud, you're actually hurting Jim, your friend, because all of his neighbors are going to shout out their windows, ah, that stinking Jim, we're sleeping, go back to bed, Jim. So you've actually caused him to be a problem. And as a result, it's you who has violated the laws of Lashon Hara. Right. And interestingly, and this relates a lot to our modern free speech discussions and debates, you can't say something Lashon Hara as a joke, frivolity and jest, and then say, oh, I didn't really mean it. That is not good enough, right? And again, quoting Proverbs, a madman who throws firebrands, arrows, and death, and then says, I'm only joking. Right. So you can't just use this language casually, hoping that you'll be able to avoid its consequences by saying that you didn't really mean it. That's where we left off, and it's a good introduction to some of the laws of Lashon Hara. We're going to pick up from there and go through the rest of the chapter, which is not very long, but covers the remainder of this bit about Lashon Hara. But it's worth saying this chapter of Hilchot Deot is really the tip of the iceberg for Jewish considerations of this topic. There's a very famous book, often known by the name of its author, the Chofetz Chaim, which is entirely about the laws of Lashon Hara, and it's a chunky book. Right? Chapters and chapters and chapters about what you can say, what can't you say, how can you say it, what are the exceptions. Linda, you raised some great questions before we started today about what about things like safeguarding? How do you say to someone that person's no good when it actually really matters? Those are the sort of things that the tradition continues to develop and expand upon. And it's really interesting to see how it plays out, including in contemporary Jewish communities, where sometimes this concept is used to keep people from saying things they should say. And sometimes it's not used enough to encourage people to behave well in how they speak to each other. And of course, as Rambam would remind us, everything is in the balance about finding that shevil hazahav, the golden path that allows us to have the best of both. But for the time being, we're back in his legalistic framework of Lashon Hara and on Halakha 5 here in chapter 7. So as we always do, I'll do my best to read it in Hebrew. We'll look at the translation, we'll consider its meaning, and try and understand it in the context of the chapter. Echad ha-mesaber b'Lashon Hara b'fnei chavero, o shelo b'fanav, v'ha-mesaper devarim shegoremim im nishma'u ish mipi ish lahazik chavero b'gufo o b'mamono, ואפילו לחצר לו או להפחידו, הרי זה לשון הרע. So more definitions of what is Lashon Hara. That last phrase, הרי זה לשון הרע, is this is Lashon Hara. But there are several cases he describes to us. Right? Someone who speaks Lashon Hara in front of another person, or when they're not there, as it translates here, colloquial, behind their back, or someone who speaks words which when someone says and hears from someone else, cause someone to say something bad about another person. That's the example we saw with the guy who goes out early in the morning. Or even causes harm to their property, mamono, their money. Or someone who speaks this kind of language simply to annoy them or to frighten them. all of these things, and it's a long list. The English actually doesn't render it accurately, but it's a list of things, cases. All of them are lashon hara. Okay, and that covers quite a few things. So that includes, by the way, we said earlier, lashon hara is when you speak about a third party when they're not there. But actually, this includes when you speak about someone when they are there. So if David and I are in a room, and Conrad's also in the room, and we go, Conrad, that beard is getting really long, right? That's lashon hara. Now, it could be that I think the beard is great. I do think the beard is great, Conrad, right? But actually, it doesn't really matter, because you're just not allowed to speak about any other person who's not in the conversation, who's not able to actually engage with it, even if they're in the same room. All the more so if they're in a different room and they can't hear you whatsoever, then it really tends towards defaming people and saying negative things. And we all do it. It's very hard to avoid. If you actually tried this practice, it would take such focus and such dedication. You'd have to record everything you said for a whole day and then go back and count how many times you violated these laws of lashon hara. It would be definitely double digits, arguably triple digits for many of us. For a few of us, maybe quadruple digits.
It's probably a, I don't know if misnomer is the right word, you know, my English isn't perfect, to call it lashon hara, because as we've learned, it's not only evil speak that you're not allowed to talk. When you talk about Conrad's beard, you're not even allowed to say that you like it, because even though, you know, that's not evil talk, it sounds, I can say that because that's good things, but that's still gossiping, and you're not allowed to gossip even positive thoughts, because that might hurt me, because I might then think, oh, he doesn't like me because I haven't got a long beard like Conrad.
Yeah. It's interesting because this is one of many examples where we tend to translate a Hebrew phrase wrong and we don't really care. So lashon hara is almost always translated as bad speech, right? But actually the ra there is not an adjective. There are two nouns put in a smichut phrase. Lashon hara could be translated many ways, but it can also be understood as not only the speech or literally the tongue of badness, of ra as in wickedness, badness, but it can also be understood as the speech of someone who is bad, right? Like a ra can also be a person who is bad. And so,
or simply wrongful speech.
Wrongful speech, right? You could understand it as incorrect rather than necessarily wicked in the same moral way. Absolutely. There's many ways to render it, but we tend to oversimplify it because we see it as an adjective when it's not. We do this a lot with lots of things. Okay. Where were we? Right. All those things are lashon hara. That was the first half of this halakha. Ve'im ne'emru devarim elu bifnei shlosha kvar nishma hadavar v'noda. Right. Here's the interesting thing. If these things were said in front of three people, then it's already been known, and the matter is public knowledge, as it renders in English. Hadavar v'noda, right? The thing is known. It's nishma v'noda. It's known. That's important because im siper hadavar echad min ha'shlosha pa'am acheret ein bo mishum lashon hara v'hu shelo yitkaven l'ha'avir hakol u'legaloto yoter, right? So if one of the three who heard that original statement tells someone else about it, it's not then considered lashon hara, because the intention isn't to take something that's private and make it public. Essentially, it's not to legaloto, to reveal it more. So just to explain what he means by this, I think, is that basically if anything said in public about someone, public being three people have heard it, then if you're one of those people who've heard this public information, then it's not lashon hara to tell someone else about it. Lashon hara, therefore, is very specifically about telling someone something which is not public knowledge, which is something that is private knowledge. And it creates a distinction that he doesn't quite have language for, of private and public, that we use that language, but he doesn't exactly. But it seems to be there's an important distinction between something which is known by only the two people who understood each other and said it versus something that's been told to three people in a public setting, which is then understood to be essentially kind of open source, right? It's in the commons. Everyone has access to that. So we get a window here into the degree to which lashon hara is arguably about telling secrets as well, right? If I tell you something and then you go and tell someone else, that's lashon hara, because there were only two people who knew it, you and me. But if I get up in front of a classroom and say, actually, you know, in my free time, I kill squirrels and string them up in a tree, then if you go tell someone else that I kill squirrels and string them up in a tree, that's not lashon hara, because I already told everyone publicly. So this dimension of it is actually quite important, and it changes a little bit the way in which we understand what Rambam's saying. Again, if you went back and recorded every conversation you had for a day, and you listened back and actually tallied up, okay, this time, you know, me and my partner were talking about that person at work, and we said, oh yeah, that person actually has a big problem with cocaine. Is that public knowledge? Is that something more than three people know? Or is that something that actually was only known between your partner and the person they work with, and you shouldn't know about it? There's a big difference there, right? And that's the way in which language harms, is because actually if something is public, it's public. Doesn't mean necessarily it's always good to go around to telling people things, but it is a little bit more of a distinction. And again, I think it has some play, by the way, Linda, to the question of safeguarding, right? Like if something is public, if it is announced in a registry that someone is a bad person or it's in the news, it's not necessarily lashon hara to tell someone else that, especially if it's for their safety. Okay, let's look at number six. Kol elu, all the people above, that is, kol elu, all these cases, hem ba'alei lashon hara, these are masters of lashon hara, meaning people responsible for lashon hara, she'asur lador b'shchunatam, it's prohibited to live in their neighborhood, v'kol sheken leishev imahem v'lishmoa divrehem, and all the more so to sit with them, or to spend time with them, and to listen to their words. So, obviously, we all live in neighborhoods of people we don't choose, broadly. Chances are, one of your neighbors probably has violated these rules of Lashon Hara set down by Rambam, and either doesn't know, or more likely doesn't care. Actually, probably more likely doesn't know. And we don't necessarily have the privilege of choosing who we're going to live amongst. But the sentiment here is actually, you as a listener bear a responsibility for who you choose to engage with. Last week we mentioned the very common phenomenon in many religious Haredi circles of putting up signs or wearing t-shirts, I've even seen, say, don't speak Lashon Hara to me. Right? You see this all the time in Israel in particular. People put outside their door, right? I don't want to hear your Lashon Hara. Don't speak Lashon Hara to me. And that's because the responsibility for not hearing Lashon Hara falls upon the person who is listening. So you, if you're in a conversation and someone is starting to talk smack about a third party that's not there, that you suspect maybe doesn't want this information to be shared, it's on you to not engage with that, to not listen to that, to stop that conversation. And actually, you can preempt that by not living amongst or socializing amongst or listening in conversation to people who are often guilty of this. He has an interesting after note here, which is rather loaded. V'lo nechtam gezar din, very high holidays language, al avotenu bamidbar, ela alashon hara levad. Right, the judgment, gezar din, we're going to see that in Unatana Tokef, the ruling of judgment, meaning the sentence that was passed upon our ancestors, was not sealed, again, Yom Kippur language, it was not sealed until, or rather, it was only sealed because of the Lashon Hara that they spoke. That was it. That was the only reason that the judgment against them was solidified, is because of Lashon Hara. This may be a specific instance that he's referencing, the famous instance of Miriam and Aaron talking smack about Moses' wife, in which they were both harmed by it with the mystery disease of Sara'at, which leads, by the way, to the common rabbinic interpretation that Sara'at, the disease, is caused by speaking Lashon Hara, that actually you get the disease because of this, because of Miriam and Aaron doing exactly this about Moses' wife. It may be that he's just referring to the broad sense of the spies or other instances where language was used in order to cause a lot of harm and thus solidify the judgment passed against the generation of the desert. We kind of leave Lashon Hara behind in a certain sense and move on to slightly different topics here. Although I think they're often related. So we'll see these two topics, which are about revenge and taking a grudge. And then we can kind of review and understand more about how these things are related. Ostensibly, these are not about Lashon Hara, but they are about social interaction. And the whole section that we've been reading emphasizes so much how important it is that the way we conduct ourselves with other people actually is spiritual matter. And especially during Elul, it's one of the things that we primarily might be reviewing when we review our behaviors. How did I speak to that person? How did I behave? Have I held grudges? Have I taken revenge, etc.? So this one, Halakha 7, is about taking revenge. Hanokem mechavero over belo ta'ase shene'emar lo tikom. Right, the person who is vengeful, let's say it's in the passive, or in the active, excuse me, hanokim, the revenger, the vengeful person, against their friend, or their colleague, as it has it here, has violated a negative commandment, a lo ta'ase, a don't do, because it says in Leviticus chapter 19, lo tikom, don't take vengeance. Right? Quite simple. Actually, there's more context to that verse, but it's part of what we call the holiness code in chapter 19 of Leviticus, which lists a whole bunch of behaviors we're expected to maintain. One of them is we're not meant to take vengeance. We're not big on vengeance. What exactly that means, we'll see a little bit more of here, but it's rather a vague concept, and the Hebrew and the English, again, don't always match. The afalp she'eino lokealav de'ara'ahi ad me'od. We've seen this many times as well. He says, even though, afalpi is even though, nose over mouth, even though it's not something which we whip someone for. I kind of feel like he says this with a degree of disappointment, by the way, every time he mentions, like, you know, it's a shame we don't whip people for this, but we don't. Nonetheless, dea ra'ahi, it's a very bad character trait, attribute, dea being the subject of this whole section, deot, and it's one of the worst, right? Ad me'od. Extremely is probably the best way to translate ad me'od. They don't really have adverbs in Hebrew, so you have to be quite creative. Ella, what do we do instead? Ra'ui lo le'adam l'hiyot ma'avir al midotav al kol divrei ha'olam shehakol etzel ha'mevinim divrei hevel v'havai ve'einan kedai linkom aleihem. What should you do instead? You should, it is appropriate for a person, ra'ui lo le'adam, to be ma'avir omidotav, to be transcendent almost. Avar is to cross over, ma'avir is to bring something over, to rise above. We actually use that language in English, don't we? I'm going to rise above it. I'm going to be the bigger person. So you are obligated, Rambam says, to be the bigger person, to rise above all those worldly feelings, divrei ha'olam. And for those who have understanding, hamivinim, the understanding ones, they need to note that all of these things are hevel v'havai, right? Hevel, of course, another good high holiday word. We're really in high holiday mode here, or at least I am. Hevel being the main theme of a Kohelet, Ecclesiastes, we read on Sukkot. Hevel, havalim, akol, hevel, right? Emptiness and vanity, whatever you translate hevel, is something that doesn't really exist. It's something that is dissipating already before you see it. It's your breath in the air in the nighttime, where as soon as you see it, it's gone. It's transience, it's impermanence, whatever. It's a very hard word to translate. It's also the name of Abel, right? The character who we translate it as a name, but it's really a concept, who is also very impermanent. He exists and then he's gone, right? He doesn't last very long, poor Abel. Anyways, Havai is similar. Havai is something which is like, oh, it's a sigh. Oof. You know, if only Havai, we have a sense of that something that is temporary and ungraspable. So his point here with this kind of poetic language, which is slightly unusual for Rambam, is basically understanding people who have wisdom and insight, know that any offense you might have taken is about something that really doesn't matter. Hevel v'havai, right? It doesn't really matter. It's something that is not going to have any real impact. It's not going to last. It's temporary. It's transient. Ve'einan kedai linkom aleihem. And therefore, they don't take revenge about it, right? Vengeful people are people who put too much stock in things which don't really matter, is his implication. Now, he wants to define what vengeance is, which is important because obviously it's quite a broad concept. So he says, our favorite word, ketzad, how? Ketzad hi hanekima? What is it exactly, vengeance? Amarlo chaviro, hashileni kardumcha. Kardumcha. Right? Which is, I had to look this up, but it's also in the translation, a hatchet, a kardum, not a word that I was familiar with. So a friend someone says to his friend, hey, can I borrow your hatchet? Hatchet's a little axe. And he says, where do we go? Amarlo, Eini mash'ilecha, Lemachar tzarich lish ol mimenu, amar lo chavero, hashileni kardumcha, amar lo eini mashilcha kederech shelo hish altani kishalti mimecha. Right, so you can tell from this, it's a rather colloquial conversation taking place. Someone comes to his friend, Reuven comes to Shimon and says, hey, can I borrow your hatchet? He says, no, no way, you can't have it. The next day, Shimon needs to borrow his hatchet from Reuven. I guess they have different hatchets. And he says, oh, can I borrow your hatchet? And the first guy, who was the one who originally asked, says, no, because you didn't lend me your hatchet, I'm not going to lend you my hatchet. It's a really weird example. I feel like it's probably personal here. So someone did not lend Rambam their hatchet and should have, I suspect. But he tells us, Hare ze nokem, right? This is a vengeful person. I think it's really important just to stop there and say, we're not talking about violence. We're not talking about someone who's got vigilante justice on their mind. We're talking about someone who is what we'd call bearing a grudge, probably. Right, who's holding someone else's bad behavior against them and behaving at the same level, who lowers themselves to match another person rather than rises above it, ma'avir midotav, as he said earlier. But it's such a mundane example.
Do you remember having to read The Hatchet in middle school?
Oh my gosh, I vaguely do, but wait, is that the one Brian something?
Gary stuck something, in the wilderness.
Gary, yeah. Gary stuck in the wilderness in Alaska.
Yeah, it's like huge in America. Every boy in middle school has to read The Hatchet. I don't know if they do it in the UK.
I haven't thought of it. They have different books here. We had to read The Outsiders and The Hatchet and all these things. I haven't thought about The Hatchet since I was 12, and I'm really
upset that I thought about it just now.
Thanks, Ben. Wow, I kind of want to read it now and see if I remember it. I don't remember enjoying it.
It's all right. It's pretty good.
My son's just started the equivalent of middle school, and they're reading The Hunger Games, first term of, sixth grade, which is, like, hardcore. Probably better than The Hatchet, but similar vibes, which is like, hey, you're now a grown-up child who's in a big school. You want to hear about how everything's horrible? It's like...
Yeah, right.
Okay. Thanks for that. Yeah. I can see the cover. You know what I mean? Like, it's just like, it's so visceral. It's see the cover.
The gray cover with the wolf on it. Yeah.
Yeah. I have no idea what it was about. Snow.
A hatchet. It's about a hatchet.
Thank you. And yeah, I'm going to hold a grudge against you now because of that. But not this kind of grudge.
But in Lokin, but so it's fine.
Yeah. We don't whip anyone. That's all right. Woof. What a relief. And we'd all be getting whipped a lot if we did whip people as much as Rambam kind of wishes we did. Okay. Ella. This is now we're still on the hatchet, although sort of. He's saying that's what vengeance is the hatchet situation. Ella kishiavolo lishol yiten belev shalem. Rather, when the person comes to ask from you, you should give to them with a whole heart. Right? Lovely language. Lev shalem. Also a high holiday reference. I feel like there's a conspiracy here. Maybe it's just a rabbi and Elul, but everything feels like a high holiday reference. Velo yigmolo. Kasher gemolo, you shouldn't repay him the way that he paid you. Right? We're not about getting even. It is unreligious and un-Jewish to always try and get even with people because of their bad behavior. Their bad behavior is their problem. Your behavior is your problem.
It doesn't say it here, but I know that I've learned elsewhere. Maybe it's from Chafetz Chaim that when you do give him the hatchet on the second day, you not only are you should you give it to him, you're not allowed to say, I'm giving it to you despite the fact that you didn't give me yours. That you're not allowed to say that, because
that totally checks out.
Exactly, because that was spoiling the whole thing. So you've just got to give it to him and not say anything. Here you go.
Oh, it's such a good point, David. Like, you could easily read this and think, oh yeah, I'm morally superior because I'm giving you the hatchet even though you didn't give me the hatchet. But actually, that's not the point. The point is not to be morally superior. It's to not sink to that level. So to give it and go, well, you know, good thing I'm nicer than you are, is really not doing the trick. I'm kind of surprised Rambam doesn't say that. I wonder if one of the commentators on this does.
Someone does say it, because I remember learning.
I believe it.
And like I say, it might have been in Chafetz Chaim, but it might be somewhere else. It might be a commentary. I don't know. But I remember that I learned that.
He's going to tell us about grudges next, and maybe he includes something similar there. Just the last bit here, you know, we've often talked about how Rambam cites sources, but, you know, he, in this section, he's recited the Psalms and the Proverbs a lot. And the same is true here. He cites Psalm 7. He says, V'chen amar David b'deotav ha-tovot. Right, thus David spoke about good attributes, not all of which David had, by the way. Im gamalti sholmi ra v'achaletza. The Gomer. That's the rest of the verse isn't quoted, but it's here in the English. Psalm 7, verse 5. Have I repaid those who have done evil to me? Rhetorical question. Behold, I have rescued those who hated me without cause. This might violate David, this David, what you just raised about, you know, you shouldn't really brag about being the morally superior party. But we can excuse King David because he put it into beautiful Psalms for doing that. But, you know, the sentence and the sentiment is exactly that of, you know, I haven't repaid people the way that they treat me. You often hear people say this, go, I treat people, they treat me. Actually, Rambam says you should treat people better than how they treat you, which is really a big ask because it's not about fairness. It's about the fact that you are actually held to a higher standard of behavior, even if everyone else is not behaving the way they should. That doesn't excuse you to sink to their level, which is a hard thing for many people to hear, and also a really important part of any ethical code is that your ethical code is independent of other people's behavior. If it's only situational, then when you're in a bad situation, you behave badly, and that's not really ethics. Okay, let's look at the last one here, and then we'll have a little bit of time for reviewing. Now we are on the subject of grudges, which is very closely related. Halacha 8. V'chen kol hanoter le'echad mi'Yisrael over belo ta'aseh. Exactly the same phrasing, by the way, except we now have the word noter instead of nokem, which is understood to be someone who holds a grudge. And also quoting Leviticus 19, so we're in the same place when we source it. V'lo titor et b'nei amecha. Right, Ramecha. Don't hold a grudge against the children of your people. Interestingly, the last one didn't specify whom you were meant to not take vengeance against. It seemed to be everyone. Here with this one, it's specifically don't bear grudges against other Israelites. Right, that seems to be more explicit. Interesting about whether that's a meaningful distinction. Rambam, of course, asked the question we all want to know. Ketzad hi hanetira? What is this grudge bearing? Netira is an interesting word for lots of reasons, by the way. And here he gives us actually names to his fake people, but a similarly ridiculous scenario. Reuven she'amar l'Shimon, hasker li bayit zeh, o hash'ileni shor zeh, ve'lo ratza Shimon. So Reuven, these are generic names. Reuven and Shimon are always the, you know, person one, person two. So Reuven says to Shimon, hey, can I rent your house? Or can I borrow you this ox that you have? And Shimon doesn't want to. That's the setting. And then a few days later, Liamim ba Shimon liRivon Reuven lishol mimenu o liskor mimenu veamar lo Reuven he lecha harini mashi lecha veeni kemotecha lo ashalem lecha kemasecha. Here we go, David. Right? Mm-hmm. Can't rub it in. So a few days later, Shimon comes to borrow or rent something from Reuven, and he says, "Here you go. You can have it, but it's a good thing I'm not like you." Right? I'm not paying you back for what you did. It's interesting, it's almost like it's worse than vengeance because it's vengeance but with a twist. So it's exactly the situation we described of, you know, very similar. It's all about interpersonal communication, but here bearing a grudge is actually where you tell someone that you're behaving better than they are. That's what it means, nitira. Nikima is acting the way that someone else acts towards you. Nitira is acting better than they do, but making sure they know it. Neither of which are acceptable, and both of which are a violation of a negative commandment, as he's made very clear with that language. This is a over lo ta'ase. Right, rather, what should we do instead? Again, same pattern as the one above. Ela yimche hadavar milibo, v'lo yiterenu. Rather, we should erase the matter from our minds and not bear this grudge. Shekol zman shehu noter et adavar v'zochero shema yavo linkom. Because all the time that you're holding this grudge and you're remembering it and you're dwelling on it and you're going around and around and around, eventually it's going to bring you to take vengeance. Right? The grudge and your moral superiority is actually going to lead you to take vengeance. Lefikach. Therefore, hikbida Torah al hanetira The Torah is really particular, hikbidah, it's really specific, it's really insistent about bearing a grudge. Ad sheyimche ha'avon milibo velo yizkarenu klal. Up until the point where it tells you that you need to erase this horrible crime from your mind and not to remember bad things that are done to you whatsoever. Vezohi ha'deya ha'nechona, this is the correct trait, attribute, she'efshar she'itkayem ba, it's possible that you can uphold Yishuv ha'aretz u'masa'am u'matanam shel b'nei adam ze im ze. Right? This creates, if you uphold this attribute, it stabilizes the whole settlement of the world, right? Yishuv ha'aretz, the kind of the stability of the earth, and in business, it makes everything better, masa'am u'matanam, and it allows for b'nei adam ze im ze, right? Interpersonal relationships between people to actually flourish. Right, so the English here is a bit better than mine. This is a proper quality which permits a stable environment, trade, and commerce to be established among people. So you can't really have the society he's envisioning unless you don't hold a grudge and don't take vengeance and don't speak badly about people who are not there in your presence, who have private information that's not yours to share, and don't eat spicy foods when it's hot out, and don't use the bathroom, you know, except for when you really need to go, and don't frequent your wife like a rooster to have sex, and don't do all the other things. And, you know, the entirety of Hilchot Deot that we've seen is ultimately a code of ethics. Now, I think it has a lot of merits as a code of ethics, and there's a huge amount that actually we could learn in our society. I think there's also plenty of things we can leave behind in Rambam's society of 1,000 years ago, particularly his medical advice. I know he was a doctor, and I'm sure he was a very good doctor, but I'm also sure if he lived today, he might update some of his advice, you know, with slightly more modern recommendations. So we can take that at face value. But some things he teaches us, particularly the stuff in this last chapter, is kind of timeless, right? How we treat each other, how we behave, how we use words, whether we hold grudges, whether we take vengeance. Those are things that aren't specific to the 12th century or any particular context. And they're things which the Torah is very insistent on and our tradition takes extremely seriously. So it's telling that he chooses those materials for his final chapter of Deot, that he leaves us in the section all about character and ethics that we've been reading now for quite a few weeks with this idea of how we're meant to be forgiving, be, you know, willing to let go of things that don't matter, use our language carefully, and ultimately prioritize our relationship with other people and God above our own personal pride and dignity. That's a big ask, but it's central to the whole project of what comes next. And I think that's really important. So thoughts, comments, questions, criticisms, anything on Deot broadly? Hi, Ayla.
Hello. I just want to apologise, firstly, for all my shuffling about earlier. I was convinced I was on mute and my video was off. And so if I was being really distracting and moving around, I'm sorry. On this, I just want to ask, are there limits on this? Like if people have actually really wronged you, either within the Jewish community or externally, like anti-Semitism, like what's the limit on how far we're supposed to not hold grudges?
It's really interesting. I think it's telling that there's a somewhat debate present in the text between who this applies to, right? The specifics of not holding grudges was, you know, el b'nei amecha, so with each other, right? Within our social group, within our identified kind of in-group, family, friends, whatever. The not taking vengeance seems broader. So I think maybe you could see that there are plenty of instances in which holding a grudge against someone who has harmed you is not necessarily a violation. But I think there's also a sense of this which suggests that it's doing damage, spiritual damage to you, to be in a mindset where your heart and your mind is taken up with other people's bad behavior. You need to make room to focus on your own good behavior, and not other people's bad behavior. And I do think there is a rich strand in our tradition which would take this so seriously that it almost feels quite Christian at times to say, you know, actually you should, you know, turn the other cheek and never respond. And there's a famous story, for instance, that's told about a group of meditating rabbis who used to be famous for their trances that they could induce. And one rabbi wants to join their group and he comes to apply to join their group. And they say, sure, you can join us. Just answer one question. You know, if someone insults you, do you do you take offense to it? And he goes, well, yeah. And I say, well, and if someone pays you a compliment, do you like it? And he goes, well, of course. They go, yeah, you're not ready. Come back when those two things feel the same to you. And that kind of, you know, whether we call it Stoic, although that's not necessarily descriptive of the real Stoic philosophy of the ancient Romans and Greeks, or whether we call it kind of equanimity, whatever we might refer to it as, that is the goal. And it's a spiritual goal, which has very little to do with real people in some way and much more to do with our aspirations for our own behavior. So it's hard. I mean, there's no part of this which is easy, but I do think that there are few exceptions that we might legitimately suggest would be part of a spiritual life, even if we're prone to them in our day-to-day lives, regardless. Robin, you got your digital little yellow hand.
Yeah. I had a similar question to Ella, but I think it goes to what we were discussing last week a bit about this sort of, and that very last sentence summed it up as being about how society functions. And yet what you just said was about the spirituality. And I think they're not mutually, they're complementary and they work together. And so, you know, if everyone were living in that way, then society would function beautifully, but also we would have a better spiritual relationship. So it's the within humans relationship and society, and the relationship beyond humanity, and they're working in harmony.
Yeah, it's very isn't it, that like Judaism is somewhat unusual, not unique, but it's unusual that the place where the most spirituality is focused is also the place that concerns itself the most with society, yeah, with social groups. The closest analog is actually Islam and the Sufi traditions, which focus on creating a Sufi brotherhood, right, where the relationship between the participants in this brotherhood is actually a central part of the spiritual life. But that's the two of those, the Kabbalistic tradition and the Sufi tradition, are very different than, say, Christian monasticism, which is, you know, lock yourself in a cell in a mountain for as long as you possibly can and don't talk to anyone, or the traveling sadhus of much of India, where it's about, you know, independent, untethered life. So it's indicative in many ways of the Jewish approach to spirituality that happens through other people. And there's some interesting examples of this, by the way. One thing I'd encourage you to look at is the community in Sfat we talked about when we learned about Kabbalat Shabbat. Right, the community in Sfat in the 16th century is hugely influential for lots of reasons. But one of the things people don't know as much about, and we don't learn about, is that they actually wrote quite a few documents for themselves. There's a constitution, almost, that was written between the brotherhood of these 30, 40, 50 men and their families who were involved in this community, in which they basically pledged to always take care of each other, to never say bad things about each other, to never hold a grudge, to never take vengeance, to make sure that they treat each other with respect, that if one of them died, they'd take care of the other one's widows and orphans. That it was like, it was a mutual assistance, mutual benefit, mutual spiritual support concept. And it hasn't shown up at too many times and places in Jewish tradition. Certainly feels very far from Jewish life today, where we don't really make that room for a spiritual social life. We see them as distinct, but it makes sense, right, that that's how we would encounter it. And certainly Hilchot Deot, especially as it builds up from what you do when you get up in the morning to the end of how you build a society where people are in connection with God, it requires other people. You can't do it alone. You need other people to prove and to test your ethical observance against. But you got to pick your neighbors carefully. Okay, we leave Hilchot Deot behind, and next week we will dive into the next section, our third section of the Mishneh Torah. We're plowing through this, guys. We're doing so good, which is going to be the laws of Talmud Torah, of Torah study, which is really very interesting, and getting us closer to what we might call halakha, in terms of, you know, what are the actual obligations the Torah imposes on us. We've seen a few of them, and it's growing, the amount of sources that actually refer to specific mitzvot in the Torah. but we'll see quite a few more in the laws on Torah study, which is basically about education, right? It's about how we teach, why we teach the way we teach, who gets taught, at what age they get taught, what the expectations are of a good teacher and a good student. It's a really interesting construction, building entirely, and Rambam did this intentionally, on that last sentence that Robin, you referenced, about how we build a society. Torah and Torah study is the foundation of the society he's envisioning. And so the process of studying, learning, respecting one's elders, engaging with the wisdom of the tradition, all of those are taught throughout the next section, of which there's also seven chapters. And we get a really interesting window into the ideal version of Jewish life, perhaps, that he lays out. So after that, by the way, just a little preview, that's our next section. Following that, we have the section on idolatry, which is wonderful. It's really good fun. Not idolatry, but the section on idolatry is wonderful and very interesting from how he understands it, which is not what you might think. And then, although it doesn't time out great for our purposes, because it'll be a while before we get there, the last section is the laws of tshuva, what is entailed by tshuva, how you need to do it, and what you need to do. And it'll be a good chance by the time we get there, perhaps, I don't know, January, to reflect on our experience of the High Holidays and the experience and practice of tshuva. There's actually, in Masorti Judaism, if you follow us on social media, we've been teaching little bits of Hilchot Tshuva from Mishnei Torah each week for the last few weeks, and there's quite a few more weeks to come, so you can keep an eye out for that. Each of our rabbis is doing some teaching about those sections from Hilchot Tshuva. But for us, we're going to start next time with Hilchot Talmud Torah and dive into the wonderful world of Torah study. So join us then.